thing can turn into one great big oscillator. If a little bit of the output signal of that third stage manages to get back to the first stage by way of the antenna input connector or whatever, the whole thing can turn into an oscillator. Second of all, to make those stages narrow enough in bandwidth so you're not amplifying a whole lot of noise, that's a big problem. Those early receivers had a huge air variable capacitor for tuning those stages. They tried to make those circuits extremely high in Q in order to make them very narrow in bandwidth so you listen to less noise and you could tune to one signal at a time. And it was a pain in the neck to build this great big piece of hardware that can do all that. That's an ordinary tuned radio frequency TRF receiver. Let me drop it.
Armstrong is the inventor, according to Wikipedia, WS2N.
Well done, Paul. Now that makes sense. I do remember hearing that name. So, Mr. Armstrong had a lot to do with that. And so he's given the credit of being a major inventor, if not the major producer of superheterodyne receivers. What a superheterodyne receiver does is it takes the incoming signal, usually after one stage of RF amplification. And the one stage of RF amplification is a little bit broad, and you don't worry about the bandwidth because it doesn't determine the overall bandwidth of the receiver. You take that incoming signal at, say, one megacycle, you beat it against a local oscillator, you put it into a second stage, which is called the mixer. The mixer has two grids, usually. One grid has your one megacycle signal you received from the first RF amplification stage. The second grid has a signal from your oscillator, and your oscillator may be set at 1.455 megacycles. So you're listening to 1.0 megahertz. You're mixing that together with a 1.455 megacycle signal. The difference is 455 kilohertz, 0.455. The output of the plate of that first mixer stage has a circuit that's tuned to 0.455. And then there's two or three more stages all tuned to 0.445. 0.455 KC, we call it. And so that would be a single mixer type, a single conversion superheterodyne receiver. The advantage is that now all you've got to do is change the tuning of that oscillator and change the tuning of one stage of RF amplification in order to tune anywhere in the band you want to. It's a much simpler tuning procedure. It's done with a ganged capacitor, which has got the two sets of plates. And when you turn the knob on that capacitor, you're tuning...
Repeater, timeout.
You're tuning the tracking of the RF amplifier. Let me drop it. You're tuning the tracking of the RF amplifier, and you're tuning the tracking of the local oscillator simultaneously with that one dual-ganged capacitor. And all the later stages, where most of the gains takes place, are all on one fixed frequency, 0.455, in my example. And to build a narrowband stage at 455 KC that's fixed tuned is very easy. To make a whole lot of cascaded stages in the TRF design, to make them high enough in Q, to be narrow enough, to keep it from oscillating, to make them all track each other as you tune across the band, it's a pain in the neck. So a super heterodyne receiver has this oscillator beating your signal down to a lower fixed frequency in all the IF stages. IF stands for intermediate frequency. So 455 KC in this example is called the IF intermediate frequency, is what IF stands for. It's a much simpler design. And in some cases, they go to another stage, another mixer stage, which takes the 455 KC and beats it down to a lower frequency, maybe 60 kilohertz, if you want a very exotic receiver with a very controlled bandwidth. And so to build a stage of gain with narrow bandwidth at 60 kilohertz, a second IF, second intermediate frequency, very simple, and you can do that with modern-day operational amplifiers, if you know what I mean. So the superheterodyne receiver, almost every radio receiver today is superhet with one exception. Let me drop it. And that is, there's another kind of very popular receiver that's done for inexpensive reasons. It's called a zero IF. You can literally build what looks like a superheterodyne receiver. But, in this example, if I want to listen to a 1 megahertz signal, I'll go into what looks like a mixer stage, which is mixing with an oscillator also running at 1 megahertz. At first it sounds crazy, but now the difference in those two frequencies is literally zero. It's called a zero IF system. As long as the phase angle of the local oscillator you're injecting compared to the 1 megahertz signal you want to listen to, as long as the phase angle is correct, that zero IF system is very effective. All of your RFID radio frequency identification tag interrogators, almost all of those interrogators are a zero IF system. In other words, the local oscillator and the signal you're listening to are one and the same. And there's certain advantages of doing that, and there's ways of making that very inexpensive. So this gives you a little bit of understanding of what heterodyning means and what is a super heterodyne receiver. It was called super heterodyne. Let me drop. Because for a short period of time, people were building receivers where they intentionally had feedback built into the receiver. And they would adjust the feedback in order to get extra gain, but bring it just below the point where the whole thing would break into oscillation. You take some of the output of one of the stages and feed it back to one of the earlier stages of the receiver. A feedback receiver does give you a lot of extra gain, but you've got this danger of it breaking into oscillation if you try to set the gain too high. So, not quite sure why they called it a super heterodyne. I guess Mr. Armstrong thought he had made a super breakthrough in design, and I think he's the first guy who patented it. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, drag your feet in case other people want to give us more information on the superhet principle. K2LIW listening.
KG2RY.
It sounded like KG2RY, Kilo Golf 2, Romeo Yankee. Go ahead, give us your name and correct me on your call letters.
K2RIW, this is Kilowatt Golf 2, Radio Yankee. Fine business. I just wanted to thank you, you know, for all this great technical information. I learned a lot from this tech net, especially this tech net. And you're talking about heterodyne and super heterodyne. Then they have double super heterodyne and triple super heterodyne. Could you touch on that a little bit?
Yes, I can. I think what they're referring to is either double or triple conversion. The super heterodyne process allows you to take, in my example, a 1 megacycle signal, beat it down to 455 KC of first IF, then at one or two stages downrange of the intermediate frequency, you build another mixer and mix the 455 KC down to 67 kilohertz, for instance. And then you could beat that down to an even lower frequency. As you use double and triple conversion in the receiver, you can build a more and more narrow IF frequency, which allows you to build more and more lower frequency IF. The IF makes a lower and lower frequency. Therefore, you can make it more and more narrow in bandwidth, and there are certain advantages of doing that. And your first question would be, gee, why didn't I beat it down to the more narrow IF in the first stage? Why didn't I go directly from 1 megacycle down to 67 kilohertz? And there's a very good reason for that. Whenever you mix an oscillator with a signal, you're going to get a sum and difference. If I mixed it with a 1 megacycle signal with a, I'm going to round off the numbers here, my local oscillator is now 1.5 megacycles. Therefore, I'm going to have a 0.5 megacycle first IF. Okay, that mixer is giving me an output of 1.5 megacycles, that's the local oscillator, 1.0 megacycle, that's the RF feed-through, 0.5 megacycle, that's the difference, and I'm also going to have a 2.5 megacycle output, sum and difference. All of the individual signals, a little bit of that comes out of the mixer.
Repeater, timeout.
And the laws of operations, let me drop them. The laws of operation of a mixer is you get all possible products. You get signal number one, signal number two, signal number one plus signal number two, signal number one minus signal number two. You get all the sums and differences. You get four output signals. And in the case of the first frequency, first IF being 0.5 megacycles in my example, for me to tune to the difference signal, 1.5 meg, ignore the oscillator at 0.5. I'm tuned to the 0.5 meg first IF. My output stage out of that mixer is tuned to 0.5. For that 0.5 stage to have enough filtering to not listen to the 1.0 direct feed through, not listen to the 1.5 meg local oscillator, and not listen to the 2.5 megacycle sum, it only listens to the difference, that's easy. If I decided to go down to 60 kilohertz in one step, where my local oscillator now would be 1.06 megacycles, I would have 1.06 plus and minus. The bottom line of all of that is now that my my desired signal at 60 kilohertz would have other signals very close nearby, and it's very hard to filter them out. The usual rule of thumb is that your first IF should be, each IF stage should be roughly 10% of the RF frequency. If you make it a much lower number, it's harder to select the good guys from the bad guys. So each stage of conversion, the IF stage of that conversion, is around 10% of the signal frequency. So if you do it in multiple steps, you can keep obeying that rule.
Repeater, timeout.
If you do it in multiple conversions, you can keep obeying that rule of 10%, and you have no problem of selecting the good guy from the bad guy. The 10% rule, your RF amplification, now there's the main thing I wanted to mention to you. Because the mixer stage in my first example, one megacycle I'm listening, and I'm using a local oscillator of 1.5 megacycles, the whole system is also sensitive to a signal at 2.5 megacycles. A 2.5 megacycle signal will also be half a megacycle away from my 1.5 megacycle local oscillator. For my RF stage to have enough selectivity that it passes the 1.0 meg signal but doesn't pass the 2.5 megacycle signal, that's easy. If I try to do it with only a 60 kilohertz offset, and now I'm listening to a second signal that's only 120 kc higher, some indifference, if you know what I mean, the RF stage may not have enough selectivity. It will allow that second signal to come through, and it'll look real. So if you follow the 10% rule, it's a usual good rule of thumb, where each stage of previous RF amplification has enough bandwidth to pass the desired signal and to reject the undesired signal of this sum and difference phenomenon. I wonder if that makes some more sense. KG2RY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KG2RY. Yes, it does, Dick. Thank you very much for the explanation. You know, I want to learn more about this. Two or three months before, I probably wouldn't know any of this. And I'm just starting to get into it, and I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, when you first get exposed to this material, it can be a slow job in the beginning, kind of difficult to understand. But step by step, you go to the right websites, you read the right books, it's all divide and conquer. You eventually, step at a time, will understand it. Very few of these circuits that we RF engineers use are rocket science, so to speak. They all are understandable. With the stuff you used to be able to buy in the bubble packs at Radio Shack, you can usually build a breadboard model of any of these kinds of circuits we're talking about. I will admit that if you're a 10 gigahertz ham radio operator, many of the components you need, you can't buy them in Radio Shack. Let me drop them. However, if you join the microwave reflector, Dr. Tom Williams, all of a sudden I can't think of Tom's whole letters, but you Google the word Tom Williams, for the last 15 or so years, 20 years, he has run this internet thing called a microwave reflector, where about 1,000 guys worldwide who are interested in the ham radio microwaves talk to each other on a daily basis. And if you decide you want to be on the 10 gigahertz ham band, and you need a so-called brick oscillator assembly that mixes your 10 gigahertz signal down to 144 megs, you want a 10.224 megahertz, 10.224 gigahertz local oscillator assembly. We call it a brick because the thing is about a 4-inch cube, all electronics that does that. And you need a brick oscillator assembly, and you tell those guys on the microwave reflector who's got one of those sitting on the shelf, and somebody will say, yeah, I got one, I'll sell it to you for $20. Brand new in the days when those things were being manufactured, they sold for well over $1,000, but on the surplus market these days, they're selling for much cheaper numbers. So you get into the right crowd of people. You still can get these exotic pods, feed horns, mixers, local oscillators, amplifiers, and so on, transmitters, receivers. So it's just a matter of joining the right group of people who help each other. That's what ham radio is all about. Okay, let's see if John's got any further questions on what we've just gone through. KC2WGB with the mailbag. Okay, let's pick up Wes first. Go ahead, Wes.
Can you say a few words about the image rejection mixer?
Yeah, image phasing mixer, image rejection mixer. There is a complicated method of combining two cascaded mixers with what looks like two separate local oscillators. The two oscillators are on the exact same frequency, but the two oscillators are offset by exactly 90 hertz. One is the so-called quadrature oscillator. So there's a method by which you combine two separate mixers, the output of one mixer feeding a second mixer, and two separate oscillators. Well, wait a minute now. No, the RF signal goes to the two mixers. The local oscillators go to the two mixers, but you offset things by 90 degrees. So by setting up two separate mixers just right, the sum and difference signals that I described earlier, that problem goes away. You literally reject either the sum or the difference. And that's depending on how you wire the thing, you can decide which one you reject. So it doesn't require filtering anymore. So with the image phasing mixer, image reject mixer circuitry, you can now violate the 10% rule. Your first IF does not have to be 10% of the RF frequency in order to have enough selectivity to reject the undesired signal. The image phasing mixer can do that for you with any IF frequency you desire. I'm not going to describe the circuit, just I'm going to tell you the fact that if you Google the word image phasing mixer or image reject mixer, you'll get a whole lot of articles with the schematic, with the explanation. The mathematics of how it works has got a whole lot of sines and cosines and tangents in there. Let me drop this. And it's a little bit difficult to plow through the mathematics of its operation and understand how it works. If you choose the right article where he makes vector diagram pictures, they really are polar diagrams of the individual signals. When you go to the right article that shows you the polar diagram of the signals coming out of each one of those two mixers, you'll very easily see how it manages to either cancel the sum or cancel the difference, whichever one you don't want. So the image phasing mixer is a very exotic circuit, not very complicated, very high in performance if it's done right, and gives you a lot of benefit. And you could say that the zero IF system that's used in many of these radio frequency identification interrogators, the actual handheld machine that interrogates the RFID tag, really is very similar to an image phasing mixer. It's a slightly different wired version of it, which gives you a I and Q output. And by properly digitally processing the I and Q output, the in-phase and quadrature output of that mixer stage, you get a lot of additional benefit in demodulating that RFID signal. And so I haven't explained how it works, a little bit complicated, but now you've got some of the right words to do a Google search, and you'll find out a lot more information on how it works and what the benefit is. KC2WGB, K2RIWJ, John.
KC2WGB. Well, you covered that very well, Dick. A lot of information there. Got a big thank you on the chat room, so that was appreciated. All right, time to go over to Paul. That's it from the mailbag. But and Paul, please give him your email address so that some of the questions can go to you. I do send them that information, but I still get the questions occasionally. I hope you don't mind. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Nice. Somebody said they had a question. Please repeat your call letters. It was quite noisy.
Hi, K1MJF. I have a quick question, if I could.
K1MJF, go right ahead. And is this Mike? MJF?
Roger, it's Mike. Mike number two.
Okay, a little bit noisy, but we're hearing you. Go ahead, Mike.
All right, how about that? Any better? I crank the power a little bit.
Okay. You're now 80% audio, 20% noise. And I'm hearing you dead full quietly on the input. So go right ahead, Mike.
Okay, thank you. I'm setting up a satellite communication station at the local observatory, amateur radio satellite station. And I have about 100 feet between my shack and my tower, and I have a 40-foot tower. I have 150 feet of heliax. Can I put a diplexer on both ends of that and feed my... my UHF and VHF signal into one end. Let it drop. Can I feed both the VHF and UHF into one end of that heliax and separate them with a diplexer at the other end to go to my two antennas? Will that work? K1MJM, back over to you, Dick. Thanks.
Yeah, will that work? Absolutely. The heliax doesn't give a darn, John. Mike. You could put 1,000 individual signals into that heliax on 1,000 individual frequencies. You may even be able to put some of those 1,000 signals on the exact same frequency by making some of them different in phase and out of phase signals. So the heliax itself is an extremely linear propagating medium that you and I call transmission line. And so you could put as many signals in there as you want. The heliax doesn't give a darn. It treats each and every signal as a thoroughly independent event. And until you do something really terrible to the heliax, like putting a diode across it, or raising the power so high that it starts arcing over, those are methods by which it becomes nonlinear, and now it starts mixing signals together. But under normal circumstances, that heliax is such a linear medium that it has no interaction of those signals. Thousands of signals can go in there. Now, whether or not you can put 1,000 signals in and separate the 1,000 signals coming out is strictly a function of the quality of the filters that you use. Let me drop. In this particular case, I guess I would call it a multiplexing filter. In theory, you can build a great big box that's a multiplexing filter where 1,000 individual frequencies go into 1,000 individual ports of this multiplexer filter assembly, and all of those signals get summed together in that box and come out with the one connector that goes to your heliax. And you can do that at the antenna end. And then build the exact same circuit on the other end and use it in reverse. And now the common port coming from the output of the heliax in the shack goes to this filter network, and out comes 1,000 individual signals on 1,000 ports. So in theory, you can build a filter network, a multiplexing filter, and use it as a summer at the antenna end and as a signal separator at the receiver end. So you can put as many signals as you want in that coax cable, including DC voltages. DC voltages, AC voltages, low frequency RF, high frequency RF. You can put as many signals as you want. The coax cable has nothing to do with it. It's to keep those signals not mixing to each other, and to keep those signals thoroughly separated as far as your circuitry in the shack is concerned. It's only a function of the quality of the filters that you build. The laws of physics will let you do that, Mike. Ain't that crazy? K1MJM, KQLIW in the TechNet.
All right, excellent, Dick. That's no hope in here. I plan on using commercially available diplexers at both ends. I hope that's going to be good enough. And a comment for the last guy you were talking to. I have a link to Tom Williams' website on the Limark TechNet website, okay? Thank you very much, Dick. K1MJM, back over to you.
So, when he goes to LimarkTechNet.com, which is the K1MJM Mike Number 2 website, Dr. Tom Williams, why can't I think of his call letters? Hey, Mike, tell me. That's it. WA1 Mike Bravo. Whiskey 1 Mike Bravo Alpha. He is the guy in the United States that for a decade or two holds the distance record on 120 gigahertz, and for a while he held the distance record on 245 gigahertz. And now Brian Justin, I can't think of his call letters, all of a sudden, he now holds that distance record. So these guys are really up there on the high frequencies. Can you imagine 120 gigahertz and 243 gigahertz holding the distance record in the United States? Now, these guys have done that, and you can read about this by going to that microwave reflector, becoming a member, and listening to their daily emails to each other as to what they're doing, what breakthroughs they're making, what hardware they need. Periodically, a guy will go to a flea market and he picks up a very exotic piece of microwave equipment that was made surplus by some particular company. Let me drop it. And these guys on the microwave reflector will ship a picture back and forth to each other and talk about the model number and say, what do you think this thing is? How was it used? I don't want to damage it. I don't want to open it up. What's inside there? What is this thing? And sometimes some pretty exotic pieces of hardware show up at flea markets, and guys eventually figure out what it is. These guys are extremely good at helping each other, getting chunks of hardware that they call unobtainium. If you need a set of mixer diodes that operate at 120 gigahertz, you go to a commercial company and try to buy that, and it's very expensive. And maybe they only make a batch of them once per year. But you go to this microwave reflector guys, and sometimes they found a box of them thrown out at a flea market, if you know what I mean, this unobtainium, and they'll sell it to you for a very good price. Unobtainium and rare ammonium are the things that these guys are trading back and forth. KC2WGB for any other comments or questions. K2IW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Now that's it from the mailbag, and wish everybody well, and we'll go on to Paul, see what news he has for us. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
As I pass it over to Paul, I'm going to mention the fact that I was looking at my slightly past recent issues of Scientific American, and I'm looking at August 2016, the August issue of 2016, on page number 62, has about a five-page article on OSIRIS-REx. OSIRIS-REx is this spacecraft that's going to go to an asteroid and take a sample and bring it back home. I think that OSIRIS-REx has already been launched, so it's in the process of doing that. And the advantage of bringing back a sample of this asteroid is that it's an extremely pristine, very early object that was formed in this particular solar system. So the material they're going to bring back, you could say, is roughly 4.5 billion years old. And by studying that material, you know something about what the sun has done over the last 4.5 billion years. you know, something about what the raw materials were as this solar system was forming. Let me drop this. And you would think that all you got to do is study the asteroids and meteorites that fall on the Earth, and you would get that information. You would think, well, by the time something comes roaring through our atmosphere, experiencing a tremendous amount of heat, hitting the ground, sitting there for a few years, being rained on, and then you pick up this piece of hardware and you analyze it, an awful lot of what you're analyzing is quite contaminated by the erosion and other stuff it was exposed to on this Earth. If you want to see the real raw material, you have to go to the asteroid. And that's what OSIRIS-REx is going to do. So this is a very nice article explaining that particular spacecraft, which I think has already been launched. WS2N with space report number 226, K2RIW. You got a poll.
Okay, very good. This is WS2N for SpaceNet report. Yeah, 226. And John wants me to give out my email. Yeah, I haven't done that in a while, but it's spacenetreport@gmail.com. And I get some comments and emails on that. OSIRIS-REx, that was launched about a month and a half ago from Florida. On Atlas 5, that was a 411 configuration. That means it had a 4-meter fairing, diameter fairing, so it was fit inside of that on top of the rocket. And then the next one stood for one solid booster, which is strange looking, but that's all they needed. So they had one solid booster attached to the side of it. And then the other one stands for the Centaur upstage rocket, the hydrogen-oxygen rocket, which is very dependable. They launched that particular rocket, that Centaur rocket, probably 400 or 500 times over the years and upgraded it, you know, over those decades. And that's, everything checks out, you know, that thing's on the way to asteroid Bennu, and I think that's around 1,500 feet in diameter. Let me drop it. And let's see, next news we'll hear from OSIRIS-REx will probably be next September when it comes flying past Earth again. It's going to use Earth as a gravity assist to swing it out to get to that asteroid. And then about another year after that, it will get right on top of the asteroid and stay there. It'll orbit it for about another year or so, taking close pictures and eventually figuring out where they want to go down and touch this thing. They have a robotic arm attached to the spacecraft. It's called TAG. Stands for touch and go. The TAG is going to go down. It's got a nitrogen charge in the arm, and when it touches the asteroid, it'll blow out, you know, nitrogen, and then, you know, down the center of this arm after it touches it, and then any of the rocks and debris that's laying on the asteroid will get forced up to the sides of the TAG unit, and then be collected there, put back inside, you know, with the arm, put back inside a craft that's going to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere. And that has a heat shield on it, probably around 2023, it will be coming back through the Earth's atmosphere, probably around 25,000 miles an hour, which is a lot. Very, very fast. The astronauts, when they come back, it's usually about 17,500. This thing comes back at 25,000 miles an hour. And that will land in Utah. They have it planned on landing in the Utah desert. And they'll go out, find out what it collected. And they'll probably study that. They said for the next 50 years. You know, the scientists get a hold of these things, and they'll study that for decades to come. That's the prediction from the principal investigator that's in charge of that mission. So, okay, Dick, you know, he brought that up, so I wanted to cover that. This is WS2N. And, of course, there's a lot more that's going to be heard from that mission as the years go on. First of all, I wanted to say that another flight is going to be going up to the International Space Station this month, a couple of weeks, on the 17th. And it'll include three astronauts, one Russian, one from the European Space Agency. He's a ham, Thomas Pesquet, and an American astronaut called Peggy Whetson. Now, Whetson has gone up two previous times, so this will be the third flight for her. She'll eventually become commander of the space station as time goes on. And they'll spend about 4 or 5 months up there, attached to the space station. And they'll join the other three that are up there now. And we have another American on board, Shane Kimbrough, and also another ham. And he's up there with two other Russians. So that will bring the crew back to six. And they'll continue on with their experiments and spacewalks. A lot of things that have to go on up there. One of the next big spacewalks coming up is to change out the original nickel hydrogen batteries that are up there, and they want to get rid of them, and they're going to install new, brand new lithium ion batteries. And now this is all on the exterior of this, all these truss sections that are interconnected. That come off the solar cells. They have these, you know, very big batteries, suitcase-sized batteries that have to be installed. A couple of EVAs are going to be involved with that.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
This is WS2N timing out the repeater. I know about a week or two ago we talked about New Horizon with the communications coming back, and I did find some information about that. The reason it takes so long, it took 16 months for all the information to come back from Pluto. We talked about this a little bit last week. July 4th, it went past Pluto. Year and a half ago, almost, you know, roughly 16 months ago, but all the information is now back, and what they have on their site, at the New Horizons site, is information about, you know, they give an example, for instance, every picture that comes back is roughly two and a half megabits. Now they deal in bits, not bytes, of information that has to be transmitted back. And it's coming back at a 1 kilobit per second. I thought it was around 600, but it looks like it's 1,000 kilobits per second. So I was wrong on that. But it takes, you know, if you do the math, it takes about 42 minutes, they said, for one picture to come back. And they have hundreds of pictures that had to come back. Not only that, plenty of information on how to come back, and they can't utilize this satellite 24 hours a day because the deep space network is involved with other spacecraft that are out there going around Saturn or Jupiter. Quite a few satellites going around Mars, so they can't dedicate all the time to New Horizons. So that's why it took these 16 months. One thing I found was that they do have not only one traveling wave tube, they have two traveling wave tubes. So they were able to increase the speed of the transmissions because one is set up for right-hand polarization and the other one is left-hand polarization. So they transmit at the same time. And they can do that because they do have enough power. Even so, they're running off kind of like low power. They have a RTG, a radioisotope thermal electric generator, creating the power. So most they get is 200 watts out of that. But by shutting some of the systems down that they don't need to use, they could dedicate all their power to transmitting. So that roughly doubles it. They said it's 1.9 times more than what they can normally get back. So that's good for the Pluto pass. They think because of the decay of the RTG over time, they'll probably only be able to use about one traveling wave tube by the time it gets to the Kuiper Belt object. Now, that, I know John asked about that. That's going to be getting to that location January 1st of 2019, so, you know, 3 or 4 years out. They're going to lose a little bit more power, and they might only be able to use the one traveling wave tube, so they'll... whatever information comes back from that Kuiper object, that 30-mile diameter thing that they're going to pass, will take even longer relative to when they pass Pluto. So, anyway, I just want to bring that up. Let me see if there's a few other topics.
NO2NO.
Six.
Yeah, NO2NO has a question, Paul. NO2NO. And also, the downlink speed. You said 1,000 bits, then you said 1,000 kilobits. Is the downlink 1,000 bits per second, Paul, do you believe? And then pick up NO2NO. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, according to that site, it was 1,000 bits per second, or 1 kilobit. You know, they wrote it up as 1 kilobit per second. And back to you.
NO2NO, go right ahead, sir. K2RIW. Start with your name.
Thank you. Yes, this is NO2NO. My name here is Fred, Foxtrot Romeo Echo Delta, on my way to Kennedy Airport because I stupidly left something there and I have to go back and get it. I have no questions. I was just listening. I rarely get a chance to listen to the entire TechNet, and so I'm happy to be here. You spoke to me like 2 weeks ago when I was on my way to Microsensor. So I'm just going to listen, basically, and chime in if I have anything to say. But you guys go on. It's a very fascinating conversation. I'm just listening to you while I'm going to Kennedy. I'm going to give it back to you. Thank you.
Very fine, Fred. One of the main reasons why OSIRIS-REx is studying the asteroid Bennu is not only is it a nice, big, pristine object sitting out there in space for billions of years, so we can find out something about what the material of the early solar system was like. Second of all, the orbit of OSIRIS-REx is going to come back to the Earth in the year 2135. The orbit of OSIRIS-REx and the orbit of the Earth intersect each other. Most of the time, those two objects, Earth and OSIRIS-REx, are not in the same place at the same time. But in the year 2135, it is going to intersect the Earth, and the current prediction is that it will be roughly halfway between the Earth and the Moon is when it goes whizzing by. And OSIRIS-REx is going to be making much more accurate measurements as to its orbital characteristics. So in the process of finding out what it's made out of, bringing back some of the sample, and getting more accurate prediction as to what its orbital parameters are, we'll know with higher precision what how close it's going to come to the Earth in the year 2135, and should we do anything about it. This article in the Scientific American, let me drop it. Picture is this. It's got a picture of the Earth, a picture of the Bennu whizzing by the Earth, and it's got this keyhole. It's got a picture that's called a keyhole. If the Bennu asteroid comes by the Earth at a particular distance, at a particular location they call the keyhole, it is going to come back again and hit us. And something that big hitting us ain't good. So should we do something to steer it in another direction is part of this mission. Near-Earth objects, there's a whole lot of near-Earth objects that are now being discovered by NASA and, as well as other space agencies. And how many of them represent a danger to us is something worth considering. There is good reason to believe that, say, for instance, the great death of all the animals on the Earth roughly 65 million years ago, that extinction period, Earth has had five extinction periods, but one of those extinction periods could have been an asteroid hitting the Earth, creating a nuclear winter. WS2N, K2RIW, you got a ball.
Yeah, and, yeah, that doesn't sound good. Rusty Stryker wants to send a satellite called Sentinel out to the orbit of Venus and take pictures, you know, keep track of every one of these near-Earth objects. Yeah, now, some of these we know about, but he said there's thousands more that we don't know about. I don't know if that comes between us and the moon. That sounds like it's close. I haven't heard that before. I know they're concerned with these things, and one of the... See, Osiris Rex, they break down the name of what those letters stand for, and one of them stands for, investigating how we could actually move one of these things. And they're thinking about the light that hits it. They're going to do some kind of testing involved with that. And they want to test a lot. You know, it stands for a lot of things. They want to investigate the possibility of using these things for minerals in the future, mining them. So Osiris Rex has a lot of things on its plate, and that's one of them. Checking the possibility of moving one of these in the future. Let me drop it.
Now, this article describes that Osiris Rex, OSIRIS-REX, stands for Origins Spectral Interpretation.
Repeater, timeout.
I'll start that again. Origins, Spectral Interpretation, Resource Identification, and Security Resolution Explorer. Try to remember all of that. OSIRIS-REX. It's a lot easier to pronounce it as an acronym than to remember all of those things, what it stands for. The article describes why each one of those words are there. And it's there because they really want to know origin, spectroscopy, resources, and security. These are the main things they're investigating. And the security really means when it comes back to Earth at 300,000 kilometers, roughly half the distance between Earth and Moon, is the current predicted flyby distance. And if it comes any closer than that, it's something to worry about. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yes, the S had to do with the possibility of, well, you know, not only is it going to hit us, but the investigation behind it on what to do with it. And the principal investigator for that, I forgot his name, but he took over after another guy had passed away a couple of years ago. But this guy himself has been on the project for like 20 years or something, so he's really into this. So during the interview, they ran through that whole list of what that acronym stood for and went all the way down the line. He was pretty good. And so, yeah, this astronaut that went on Apollo 9. He only went up on one flight. Rusty Swigert is in charge of this telescope that they would like to put up. And he's looking for funding, and he's having a hard time getting the hundreds of millions of dollars that they need. So he's trying to convince Congress, and that's not an easy thing to do. So, what I was looking for this week was this Virgin Galactic spacecraft 2 to be tested by Virgin Galactic. Richard Branson runs that company, and they're going to test this out in California, and they want to drop it from the White Knight. It's been taken up a couple of times already by the White Knight. That's the carrying airplane that carries this thing, and eventually we'll be able to carry back.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
Now, this is the second space plane that's been built. First one, while they were testing on the rocket tower 2 years ago, broke apart, and injured one pilot and killed the other. But since then, they built the second one, and now it's ready for testing. And right now, it doesn't have any rockets on it. They want to test it. Flyability, bring it up to 50,000 feet, let it go, and let it come back and land. And it was supposed to do that the other day, but they scrubbed that because high upper winds, and they didn't reschedule it. So I don't know what's going on there, but I'd like to see what happens with that. Another thing I wanted to talk about is JAXA, that's the Japan space program, Japan Aerospace. They launched their own rockets from Japan. They launched another one the other day, bringing up a weather satellite to geosynchronous orbit. So that's another launch for them. But the next big launch, as far as I'm concerned, for them is the one coming up in December. They are bringing up the HTV, which is a cargo vehicle carrying around 10,000 pounds of supplies to the International Space Station. They've done this once a year, I think it's their fifth flight, and about once a year they'll do this, launch it from Japan and dock with the space station. Well, berth it with the space station, and then they'll proceed to unload everything, and then load it up with a bunch of trash and send it back. But this particular one was supposed to send up a couple of months ago, 3 or 4 months ago. And as they were doing some pressure tests, they realized the vehicle had some kind of a leak. So they went back to the shop to get repaired. Now it looks like it's ready, and they should be able to send that out. They do need more cargo up there. Now they have 6 people on a regular basis. The last flight by SpaceX Dragon has been temporarily delayed. SpaceX is the one that had a rocket malfunction on the launch complex 40 that they use on a regular basis that blew up September 1st, and they're still getting to root of that problem. According to Elon Musk, the owner of that company, they figured it out. They've duplicated the problem out in McGregor, Texas, where they have a test facility. So he believes that they should be starting to refly in December. I don't know if that's true yet, but we'll have to see. Have some problems with the fueling. Now NASA is getting on their case about the way they fuel their rocket. You know, over the last 40, 50 years since we've been putting people into space, they fuel the rocket, you know, man flight, they fuel the rocket after Everything's checked out. It's completely fueled, kerosene or hydrogen, whatever they're using. And then they bring the crew out and get on board and hope to take off. SpaceX doesn't want to do that. Right now, they've been doing it a little differently. The last, you know, four flights that they've, you know, taken off from Florida, they call it full thrust, or Falcon 9 full thrust, which means that they came up with a new system to load propellant into the rocket. Normally they'd load, well, in this case, kerosene and liquid oxygen. And it's very cold. It's cryogenically cooled. But they went a step further and brought each one down around 50 degrees colder than normal, almost to a solidifying temperature of liquid oxygen and liquid kerosene. But to do that, they have to do it right before they launch, like within a half hour. So, the way it's been going, naturally, they haven't launched any people yet with this. They plan on eventually putting people on top of the Falcon 9. But NASA is saying, well, wait a minute, you know, you're doing this with the satellites and with the cargo going up to the space station. Maybe that's not going to be such a good idea when you have the people involved. Had some old-time astronauts involved, one guy from Gemini, another from Apollo in the shuttle days. They're starting to, that are still involved with NASA, are letting them know that, you know, something might have to change here, which is going to be a problem for SpaceX. They need that extra fuel in there. It's called densifying to not only get these heavy rockets to geosynchronous orbit, but they need enough fuel left to come back and land. They come back and land in Florida. They've done that twice with their booster. And then a half dozen times they've landed on these barges, 400 miles out to sea, come down and actually land at dead center of a bullseye on a barge the size of a football field, and then it'll come back to land. They haven't reflown yet. They plan on doing that. That's the ultimate goal, to refly these things to bring down the cost. So I thought that would be interesting to talk about. And we have competition from China. China just launched Long March 5, a brand new rocket from a brand new launch facility in China, right near the China Sea. And this is equivalent to our heavy lift vehicles. The heaviest lift vehicle right now that leaves Earth is called the Delta IV Heavy, which we do that. Next in line after that is the Ariane 5 by European Space Agency. This is in that category, so China is really, you know, stepping up to the plate. And if anybody doesn't think there's a space race going on, we're still way ahead, but, you know, they're coming behind us. I guess that's it for now, Dick. There's more topics, but this goes on and on. I thought we were going to run out of space topics. That hasn't happened. K2RIWWS2F.
You thought the space report would run out of space topics? And I thought that the TechNet would run out of subjects to be discussed. And I predicted that was going to happen 30-some-odd years ago. There's always new guys coming in. There's always new kinds of ham radio being invented. We're up to something like 27 different kinds of ham radio right now. And so when the original founders of the TechNet, way back in 1982, started this thing, we expected it to last a couple of months. There's always more. I think the United States is up to something like 750,000 licensed radio amateurs, roughly 1 per 500 in the general population. That makes it slightly rare, but there still is a lot of us. So, and is roughly one ham, one serious microwave ham radio operator per 1,000 hams.